Before Jack Parr, before Johnny Carson and Dick Cavett, and certainly before Merv Griffin, whoever he is, there was a national NBC, a late night television show by a man of unusually protean, that's E-A-N, talents. He played piano, eclectically but ebulliently. He wrote and participated in skits, but most of all he ad-libbed with a wide-ranging reference of knowledge and a swift sense of the unexpectedly comic that was continually astonishing to watch night after night. Having given you enough hints, I'll say I'm referring to Steve Allen, who has continued in television while also writing books and songs and playing jazz clubs and becoming involved, as is his custom, in spreading the word through what must be an enormous mailing list of all kinds of injustices. He is a phenomenon. He's even controversial. You're hardly invisible on television now, though you don't have your own particular series. And you've had syndicated shows, something like the old NBC, was it called The Tonight Show?
Yeah, it was called The Tonight Show. The first year it was called The Steve Allen Show, and then when it went full network, they changed that to Tonight. They had that Tonight, Today.
Yeah, Tomorrow.
Tomorrow, whatever.
But what I wonder about is, how come when you're so good at this, it's the Carsons and the Griffins who make all the bread and take up all the time?
Well, I had my crack at it. You know, everybody can't be champ at the same time. I did it for 3 years, and I quit. I wasn't fired. As a matter of fact, the NBC people wanted me to continue to do it and my old Sunday show at the same time, but I learned shortly that the combination was physically impossible. So since the Sunday show paid literally about 6 or 7 times as much as the Tonight Show, it was obvious which choice, you know, I would make. And I've never regretted that. I did the once-a-week comedy thing for the next 5 seasons. Then, subsequently, as you've said, I did 2 other cracks, each lasting for, I think, about 3 years or something, at the same general kind of format. And whatever it was, it added up to, I think, to about 11 years of talk show. So, you know, that's a lot. I have no complaints about that. I would be unhappy if I couldn't work in television anymore, but I'm working on it every few days.
It's the phenomenon itself that's always interested me. After you, I would watch Parr more often than I ever intended to because of the unpredictability of the man and the feelings rising and overwhelming the screen. After that, I've really gotten not only turned off but angered. I mean, I find Carson repellent. I mean, really repellent. That kind
insect
of...
insect repellent.
Yeah, right. That plasticity. And Griffin is just dumb.
Well, that's because you're looking for something that those two guys don't have. obviously, a lot of people, you know, dig what they have. You would, I'm sure, prefer Cavett, then, to the two you've named, because Dick has ideas, and he has courage, and he'll deal with an issue. And as you've mentioned, I was willing to do that sort of thing. I don't know what I can say about that. I think Johnny does a very good job in his way, and you're right, he won't touch an issue with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah. Well, what I was wondering was, you came on in this compressed history of the medium television, in the early days of television, practically, and in a way, it was freer then.
Yes, much.
Mainly because the bureaucracies weren't as large or as fixed or Lord knows what. The failure of Cavett to last, which he blames in large part on ABC to publicize the show, to push the affiliates, was that rather, however, an index that even you couldn't make it anymore on late night doing the kind of things you did? You weren't as consistently involved with issues as Cavett, but you were pretty controversial.
No, I think the main reason why Dick Cavett, as you say, failed opposite The Tonight Show, and Merv Griffin failed opposite The Tonight Show, and then went on to enormous success in syndication, is the strength of The Tonight Show. The Tonight Show is an institution, which would figure to be the case after 3 years of me, 5 years of Jack Parr, and now about 13 years of Johnny. And we don't even have to add up the arithmetic. We already know it's an institution. Yeah. It's like, you know, the Grand Canyon or the East River or something. And you can't beat it in kind. I don't know what could. Nothing ever has, except on a given night or so. I've done a couple of specials the last couple of years that have beat it on one night, but that means nothing.
What were the contents of those specials, for example?
They were pure nonsense. One was a thing called Hi-Ho Steverino. It was a roast pseudo-tribute to me on my 25th anniversary in television, or celebrating my 25th year, I should say. And the other one was a show that I do for the ABC people late night once a year. It's a steady job once a year. It's a satire on Miss America-type shows, or Miss Universe shows. It's called this will be the third unofficial Miss Las Vegas Showgirl Beauty Pageant. It's got a 19-word title deliberately. So those were comedy specials, which were really of primetime caliber, and it's not too surprising that they knocked off an average, you know, night of The Tonight Show. But over the long run, you can't beat The Tonight Show. It is such an institution, I argue, that at this point, if Johnny got hit by a truck, you could put a chimpanzee in that chair. And
how
I think,
about Dad McManus?
Well, I think it would literally take about 6 months to hurt the ratings. Yeah. Eventually, people would say, well, listen, we can't go on watching this dumb thing forever with that stupid monkey there, you know.
Yeah.
But it would take that long to move.
Oh, that's a dismaying analysis, and it's probably
in other words, it wasn't Dick's fault, and it wasn't Merv's fault. Merv moved out of that particular ballgame and swung after that, you know.
But do you think that in some other slot at late night, and I'm not talking about Tom Snyder, who I find incomprehensible, among other things, that a relatively intelligent and funny person might have the chance to pick up a literate audience, and there really are millions of literate people.
Oh, yes. There was really nothing significantly wrong with the show that Dick Cavett did, nor was there anything seriously wrong with what Merv did, unless, you know, you miss the one dimension that you would require as a viewer.
Intelligence.
But
I think it's a put on, because I remember him when he was a singer.
Yes.
And he was a very intelligent, I mean, he could talk about music in ways that most critics can't, which isn't saying much. But then he gets on mass television, and it's as if he deliberately got struck stupid.
Well, whatever he's doing, it works for him, you know.
All right, analyze that for me. You're very good at this. What is the appeal, and I use that word mystifiedly, of a Merv Griffin?
I think this, whatever I'm able to come up with here, would also apply to Mike Douglas, and sometimes people do put the names together.
Yeah.
I think there's several factors involved. One would be the factor of identification. That even happened with Ed Sullivan, who could not complete an English sentence. You know, God love him, he was a nice person, but he was inarticulate. And it was the very fact that he was so inarticulate and so awkward and so really dumb verbally. He was not dumb, actually. He could write. I think people had the idea that that's one of us up there. They didn't feel...
The old identification thing.
Yeah, it's just like a regular guy. I know, you know, everybody has a brother-in-law who talked better than Ed Sullivan, you know. And
we have a president who has that sort of appeal.
Yes, exactly. Gerald Ford fits definitely in this category. Very nice man who's rather inarticulate.
Keeps getting hit by cars.
And falling off airplane steps and stuff.
Yeah.
Accident-prone president, a first. And then also in the case of Merv and Mike... They, believe it or not, are pretty good interviewers. Merv is a much better interviewer, talking now almost in the journalistic sense.
Yeah.
He gets stuff out of the person that he's questioning. You do this very well, but of course you're a practiced journalist and a writer. But they do it, however they arrived at it, who knows, because they both were singers.
Yeah.
And Merv, I think, actually gets himself curious about all those, even some dull people that he interviews.
About
obviously,
90% of the people he interviews are pretty dull.
But look at what a great literary artist can do with, you know, a simple peasant or a truck driver or something. He can take this simple person and realize that there are millions of really fascinating things about him. Anyway, another thing is that, this is a minor consideration, but may have some relevance, that... Merv is a singer, and he works with music in the first few minutes of his show.
Yeah.
He stopped, thank God, doing a comedy monologue, which I think was one of the things that hurt him on CBS. Yeah. Johnny is a comedian, and Merv is not. So Johnny.
Yeah, I will say that. I mean, as I guess I indicated, I'm not a firm admirer of him. I do appreciate his timing. It happens to be the same timing all the time, but it's good
yes.
timing.
Well, Johnny does you the favor of, you know, not showing up a lot. I even jump in behind the desk occasionally. They'll call me and say, can you do it next Friday, and whatever. I also do the same for Merv from time to time. But those shows, I think, part of the success of them is their blandness. And that's part of the success of the hosts of them, of some of them.
Yeah.
You don't really want a person who's an intense talent like, say, Sammy Davis or Jerry Lewis. They're terrible at that. They have 10 times as much talent, let's say, as Merv.
I try to watch Sammy Davis do something like that in a syndicated series on television with William B. Williams, who was kind of a monotone both intellectually and every other way. And what struck me there was it seemed like a continual dinner of tribute to Sammy Davis Jr. and all his good works.
Yeah, that's dumb. It was sort of like a dinner, especially in the early going there. But my point is that most of the talented people in the business couldn't host a talk show. And I'm talking about a great singer like Frank Sinatra, he would be terrible. A great actor like Marlon Brando, he would be worse.
Yeah.
There are some people with talent, like for Peter Ustinov, for example, would be a good talk
show. Oh,
he'd
be marvelous, because whenever it was dull, he would simply put on another accent or tell a story.
Yes, because he's very literate and highly intelligent and a raconteur and that sort of thing. But talent generally has nothing much to do with hosting a talk show. If you have a little talent, that's nice. I can go over and play the piano, or, you know, I can act in a sketch or something. But look, I'm off, you know, and the guys who don't do that at all, who just sit there and say, oh, how did you make your latest movie? They're on.
Would you like to be on, to have a
I really wouldn't want to do a 5-night-a-week talk show gig again. I like to work on television, you know, I like to perform, and I do perform a lot. But I wouldn't want to take that kind of a scene on again. What if I could make the choice of what I'd like to do about 10 or 12 comedy specials a year. There's one, in fact, that I may this very day find out about, hopefully, that we will be doing it. It will be a 60 or 90-minute comedy special that I will write based on a sketch I wrote some years ago. I originally conceived the idea for it back about 1952 or 3, but I lacked the courage to do it then, and I think rightly so, because it was a satirical concept, and the object of the satire was the fundraising telethon.
Ah!
And it's a very delicate issue to work with because of the obvious factors of, you know, you're not making fun of sick children and that sort of thing. That's not the point. You're making fun of Jerry Lewis and the people that bring the sandwiches and the stars that try to plug their movies instead of the disease and all that. So anyway, we finally did it on a comedy show I did for CBS in 1967. And it's published, in fact, in my latest book in that form, a book called Schmark, Schmark. But anyway, it's in there. The script of it is in there. And it would really be better in 60 or 90-minute form because then you can really stretch out and do a satire of a 24-hour telethon and have a lot of laughs with it. So that may come through.
We'll come back to comedy soon, but some years ago, you got me involved, and I was grateful, very grateful at the time, because I was dead broke, in doing a script for a show that you later put on. It was called Meeting of the Minds, and I had to do a thing on punishment.
Crime and punishment, yes.
Yeah, as crime and punishment was debated by, among others. Do you remember those people? They're all through the ages.
Some of them, Dostoevsky, Hegel, Montaigne.
You know, we went back to Greece. I think Aristotle. I remember Aristotle because I had a hard time finding
anything
really, really congruent in Aristotle. And I went through the Adler book and hours upon hours and constructed what I thought was an extraordinarily stiff and unplayable script. And then what did happen to it?
Well, your script was actually quite good, and I made it slightly more playable by putting in a few... I put in some conversational lubrication, you know, interruptions and people saying, what was I saying now? And, you know, that sort of thing, which we all do all day long. But as you will recall, some of your listeners might or might not, we scheduled that for inclusion into my show, the NBC comedy show I was then doing, in somewhere around 1959-ish or so. And about 2 days before airtime, NBC yanked it out of the show. It was their network, after all. I couldn't beat anybody up and rush in front of a camera and do it. So they paid the actors off. I think it cost them about $14,000 to dismiss some very gifted
actors.
Why
did they not like my brilliant script?
I'll tell you why. I didn't find this out till years later.
You were discussing what happened to a script I'd written on assignment from you, which concerned the age-old issue of crime and punishment, and was written in the words, more or less, but mostly more, of actual savants through the ages, and then was yanked from your Comedy Hour show on NBC. Why?
Well, sir, the idea of Meeting of Minds was, as probably is already clear enough, you bring together around a discussion table or on a talk show important personages from history, and you discuss war or sex or rape or ping pong or whatever the important issue might be, and you see what Thomas Jefferson really had to say about it, or Lincoln had to say about it, or Thomas Aquinas. And as you and I have long since agreed, it's a heck of a good idea. But here, nevertheless, is why NBC yanked it out of the program. Just coincidentally, at that time, the Carol Chessman case was something that had captured the public interest. And
By the way, on the basis of experience, I have to say to some of the younger listeners here that Carol Chessman was a man who was in prison. He was about to be executed. He had not, as I recall, committed murder. It was a series of rapes, as I recall.
Yes, he was called the red light rapist or something like
that. And that was one of the first cases to really focus a fair amount of public sentiment, pro and con, on the whole question of capital punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And just to add something to what you've said, Chessman was in jail for an awfully long time, something like 10 years or something of that sort. And he, as a human being, had evolved a great deal, and undoubtedly more than he would have out on the street. He had educated himself, he'd studied, he'd read, he was able to do some writing, and he studied his own case and became a bit of a social philosopher. So that part of the issue there, part of the controversy was, is it or is it not right to kill this man, who is very different now, 11 years
That's
later,
right.
after he committed his terrible crimes, assuming he did indeed commit them, which I did assume. And anyway, I had already taken a public position as against capital punishment, so a woman came up to me, I don't know who she was, I don't think I ever saw her again, on the street one day, and she said, I understand that you're opposed to capital punishment. I said, yes, and she said, well, then, how do you feel about them killing Carol Chessman? I said, it logically follows that I'm opposed to anybody being killed like that. So she said, fine, that's what I thought you would say. May we use your name on this whatever? I said, sure. So several days later, I read Steve Allen protest, you know, that she had given it to some... I don't complain about that, but that's why you can use your name for that purpose. So this alarmed the Plymouth people, who were then the Chrysler Plymouth people. They're my sponsors on the NBC show.
All the folks who wanted people to get executed wouldn't buy Plymouths, right?
That was sort of their fear. And, of course, they get the usual 17 angry letters or 6 angry letters, whatever the number was, saying that. They always say that. They say, if you ever do so-and-so again, I will never buy Coca-Cola or smoke at Chesterfield or whatever. And I don't know why giant corporations are unnerved by 12 letters, but they apparently are. Anyway, this did cause some fear and trembling at the agency and on the part of the Chrysler people, which, of course, they immediately communicated to the network. The network, in turn, passed the pressure along to me. They had already gotten a little touchy about me anyway, because I used to go on the air every Sunday and promote a book, recommend a particular book.
I remember, yeah.
It was always very tame stuff, you know. Yeah. It was like by Albert Schweitzer, by Norman Cousins. You know, these are not wild
That's
names.
That's a dangerous fellow, that Norman Cousins. He believes in something like world peace.
Yes, and common sense and radical ideas of that sort. Anyway, and you know, sometimes it might even be a novel, whatever. There was never anything the least bit, in my view, seriously controversial at all about these books. I just thought they were worth reading. So they were already touchy. And then when this issue came up, I later learned this. I wasn't able to find it out while the argument was going on. They feared that I had commissioned you to do this script about Crime and Punishment as a way of somehow saying something about the Chessman case.
Uh-huh.
And as a matter of fact, the two things were never at any time connected in my mind. When I heard that later, I thought, oh, what a dumb idea. I didn't think that at all. You know, the reason I selected Crime and Punishment and asked you to write on that was I knew that this was an idea which some people would automatically reject as stuffy or, quote, too intellectual, end quote, or too academic and that sort of thing. So I thought, I can see their point. If we were talking about beauty or what is truth, you know, some people could fall asleep during that if we didn't watch our step. So I'll pick a really juicy, commercial, flashy subject. And what's more flashy and commercial than Crime and Punishment? Because you're talking about hanging and rape and murder and, you know, prison and that sort of thing. So I thought, how commercial can you get? And yet I didn't get commercial enough, apparently.
It was finally shown somewhere because I saw it. I saw people in Greek robes.
Yes, it's been shown several times. We did sort of a third version of your original draft on the Westinghouse series that I did in the early 60s, and the world didn't shake at all. The Westinghouse people were wonderfully supportive when I told them I had that idea. They said, oh, great. They said, we remember all that controversy. We'd love it. We'll get good publicity out of it. And, you know, there was a little publicity for about 20 minutes, and the world went on. And then I did nothing more with it for some time, although over the years, every 8 months or so, I would get a letter from some church or university or club, people who had heard of the script, and they'd ask for the script. And I must have gone out to a dozen groups, and I'd later hear that it was staged. Somebody would send me a review from Altoona, Pennsylvania, some group put it on. And it never caused any trouble at all. It never caused anything but information and enlightenment. So finally, I was doing a series just until several years ago, and one day I took 90 of our minutes, which generally were devoted to talk and fun, and did Meeting of the Minds in the proper form, which is the 90-minute form. I think that's the ideal length for it, because if you have Thomas Aquinas there, you can't hold him down to 7 minutes like you would on The Tonight Show, you know. So anyway, we had Cleopatra and Thomas Paine and Thomas Aquinas and Theodore Roosevelt, and they discussed, oh, naturally, certain historical and personal material, and then they got into the questions of war and empire and, you know, all that. So the thing won 3 separate Emmys from the Los Angeles chapter, and we got incredible mail, more congratulatory mail than I, for one, have ever either received or even seen, including a beautiful letter from Will Durant, who said he thought it was one of the finest things he'd ever seen on television.
That's interesting, yeah.
That was really
interesting. I mean, as the preeminent popularizer of philosophy, that means something. I mean, it's easy enough to put down both Durant and what I did and what you did, and I put it down, as a matter of fact. But there are people who dig that sort of thing, and the hope always is that it will lead them to go exploring for themselves.
Of course. It would be great if everyone would, you know, read from beginning to end of the great books, or
That's what it was, the Synopticon. How did I ever forget it? That's how I got all the stuff.
Yeah, well, that's very convenient. We should all have all of Plato's works in our homes, but we don't, and we have to start with that reality, you know.
Also, I think, the more I think about it, whether it plays or not for adults, it's a very good way for teachers to get kids involved, because if you really get kids involved in researching historical figures on a subject so that they get into debates, then the kids get into debates, and it begins to be alive rather than just yet another series of textbook situations.
We had contacts from schools, educators who saw the show in Los Angeles, and borrowed either the tape or a film of it that I subsequently had made and did use it in schools with great success. Little, you know, kids 12 years old or high school kids a little older who had never even heard of some, you know, they'd heard of Cleopatra because they, you know, they made a movie with Elizabeth Taylor. They weren't even sure they heard of Theodore Roosevelt, and naturally names like Thomas Paine, Thomas Aquinas meant practically nothing to them. They got so excited about the argument and debate. I added a factor to the show, by the way, which was not in the original form. There were no, you know, jokes. I mean, we didn't descend to that level. But there are humorous bits of byplay and normal intellectual conversation.
Yeah.
And we deliberately did that. We got a great thing going between Aquinas and Paine, one a believer and one an unbeliever. So they were at each other's throats in a gentlemanly fashion right away.
Doesn't sound like Tom Paine.
Anyway, there was some humor in that.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Going back to something you mentioned earlier, you had a sort of a 25th anniversary in television celebration or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Having been around for that period of time and being, you know, I mean, what it's true, you're one of the few intellectuals in the business. You just normally analyze things. You can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
How is it now? That's a nice abstract, amorphous question. By contrast with whatever hopes you had for it, not in its infancy, but certainly in its adolescence a quarter of a century ago. Are you disappointed by and large? Or?
I'm disappointed, but the disappointment is not emotionally acute because...
You're working.
Because I reined in my expectations for the industry many years ago.
Why?
Well, simply on the basis of experiential reality. Finally, we did get the thing many of us had been demanding for years, television without commercials and therefore without influence by sponsors who had to be concerned by commercial considerations. We have the PBS, we have the individual educational stations, and they have brought us a lot of glorious things. They also bring us a lot of stuff like cooking and stuff that I don't see that that's that important, but that's okay.
I still wish we could somehow have, and I don't know why the logistics are such that we've never been able to. Well, I guess I do. It's the history of the medium is so different in both places. Why can't we have the mixture that England has, that Britain has,
mm-hmm.
where you have Weekend and other commercial networks that produce not all good, but certainly some first-class shows, and the BBC itself, which has its various channels. Somehow we live uneasily here, not between public television and commercial television, but they're quite separate, and yet public television has not yet gotten its own identity nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're unlikely to resolve this dilemma in the confines of this room. It could be worse, as it is in Japan. I was over there working recently and watched TV in the afternoon, and it's dreadful. The sorts of things that we complain, and rightfully so, that our children see too much of, the, you know, cartoons where every cat eats every mouse alive and every elephant walks into a brick wall and falls down and deflates and stuff. They have 10 times as much of that incredible cartoon violence.
Yeah, let me stop you there.
In Japan.
The thrust of the argument here by pediatricians and psychologists and psychiatrists and the Surgeon General's report is that the more of that violence you have on television and kids shows, the more violent kids you're going to have. But apparently the Japanese kids aren't violent yet, are they?
Well, I think there is a rise on the violence chart, the street crime chart, the juvenile delinquency chart in Japan.
Yeah.
Now, this doesn't establish a cause and effect relationship, because you'll never will be able to do that simply because you can't isolate the two factors that you're curious about. There are 10,000 factors that get into the pot. But Japan is having Western-style problems, you know, pollution and urban congestion and all that sort of thing. But I was dumbfounded by what I saw on Japanese television. It has many of our faults compounded and compressed.
Last question. What is Japanese primetime television like, or for that matter, do they have an equivalent of Johnny Carson or the ineffable Merv Griffin?
I didn't see anything of that sort. I don't think the talk show is an institution. Either it's not there or it isn't very important, because I watched several hours of television on several different days and saw nothing of that sort. They have kind of Beatles-type groups there, rock groups. They imitate American music. In fact, if you turn on the Japanese radio, about 70% of what you'll hear is American music.
Yeah.
And the audience in a lot of their shows seems to be squealing teenagers. It's reminiscent, as I say, of the early days of the Beatles. And there's all a kind of a loose mayhem. It has the atmosphere of an American telethon. You know how at a telethon the audience never is really paying attention to what anybody on the stage is doing? That's how it is in Japan. The kids are eating candy bars and squealing at the singers. And instead of laughing at the jokes, they squeal at the jokes, which as a comic would drive me nuts, but they do it.
Well, now you can repair yourself to your television sets with some sense of gratitude, at least by comparison. Bob Hope once referred to him as the Adlai Stevenson of show business, which would make Bob Hope the Spiro Agnew of comedy. But there are certain analogies between Adlai Stevenson and Steve Allen. A wit, for instance, that can be sharp without being malicious, and even sometimes be quite graceful. Both also could be characterized as liberals politically, though that word is very amorphous these days. However, Steve Allen is more outspoken about a good many controversial issues than Adlai Stevenson ever was. But I suppose what Bob Hope most meant, if he was really thinking, was that Adlai Stevenson and Steve Allen both possessed an acute and really quite therapeutic sense of the absurd. He's a valuable man, Steve Allen, and I wish he had Johnny Carson's time and Merv Griffin's time. And, well, okay, we'll stop there. My guest has been Steve Allen. This is Nat Hentoff.